Welcome back. We're at the fifth module. Again, I also thought in the second module that I was going to be eating right away. So we're in the fifth module. We're going to be talking about just kind of finalizing the UI a little bit and connecting what we've done so far in terms of the UI and connecting it to the back end so that you can see how that actually works in terms of, hey, making that UI work, submitting something, and then seeing those messages roll in. As you will. So we're going to talk about a couple things in this module. Is again, we're going to talk about adding libraries to the front end. We're going to talk about jQuery Socket IO. We're going to cover a little bit of stylus to show you how that works. We previously mentioned in terms of middleware stylus compiling down to CSS. So we're going to just point that out and show that. We're going to also talk about, you know, if you're using Socket IO and we're working on the front end, how do we listen for messages and how do we send messages? Previously kind of already done this on the back end a little bit. So we're going to look at the front end a little bit here. So we're going to have to add some libraries to make these things work on the client side. And so two of the libraries that we're going to be using, and one of them we kind of even just went through and glossed over a little bit, was jQuery. So we're going to look at jQuery. We're going to look at Socket IO. You're going to explain that behavior in detail. And we're going to take a look at how can we wire everything up in, you know, from that UI.
All right.
So let's take a look at how do you use those and what does it look like and
yeah, so
behavior.
Yeah, awesome.
There we go again. Awesome. That's one point.
Yeah. I think someone in the chat room should keep a track how many times I say awesome. But anyways, so we want to add jQuery to our project. Mm-hmm. jQuery is this extremely commonly used library for JavaScript front-end development. It lets you...
What year was it created? Do you know?
It must be like before I even started coding.
I honestly, my response is like, to be mean and say years ago. I think it was 2006 or 2007, but I don't know. It seemed right to me.
Sounds about the time I probably started coding a little bit before then.
I'm not
that young.
Coding.
I'm not that young.
Then grew beard.
Well, I like fake coding. Just like, you know, tapping on the screen. I don't
know. Call it T-Rex typing.
T-Rex typing, exactly. awesome, cool. So, jQuery is this awesome library that lets you turn all the different browser quirks across the different types of browsers out there, and so stabilize the base JavaScript API and the DOM API across all of those different browsers. And it provides you with some really cool functions that you can use to select various elements in a way that's super easy, that's super flexible, and that you can use to create some dynamic websites.
Right. So I think at the beginning, when we thought about browsers, non-modern browsers. I don't know what that even means. But So long ago, back in the day, I used to walk 4 miles and use vendor prefixes. But, you know, thinking about those kind of things, like, it was, you know, how you might have done, a typical AJAX request, you know, one of those kind of things would be different across all the browsers. You know, some of that behavior stuff was different. So I think it was created originally to, like you said, create a baseline for the behavior and abstract it out. So you had one API into that, you know, and
exactly.
It took care of all the logic behind it.
Yeah, it took care of the little intricate details between different browsers, mm-hmm. Handled most of the stuff that might have been missing in some browsers as well. Some DOM APIs might not have been available. Mm-hmm. jQuery added those missing ones.
Right. DOM manipulation, like accessing an element, adding something to it. It was, and often sometimes, you know, there's still differences between some of the browsers. So it also, you know, people used it a lot for that too.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
So it was a great library. You're right.
It was and it is.
I was going to say it still is, but then you like jumped right in. I can tell Stacy is a huge fan of jQuery.
I think jQuery has started off, I think years ago it really, I think it's important to understand why it was created and right. what it did, and also how maybe that's not as necessary now,
yeah.
but that it still provides a lot of really great functionality in terms of DOM manipulation. I mean, I think people use it typically for abstracting that kind of behavior, mm-hmm. DOM manipulation, and animation. Right, I think a lot of people use it for those things. Even though we have, you know, CSS3 with all those kind of animations, I think people still use it quite a bit for that, which is totally, in my opinion, great. I think it's awesome to use. I also just think jQuery is not JavaScript; they're not the same, you know. And
yeah,
people
that's true.
Kind
some,
of
some people, yeah, there might be a little bit of a confusion when someone asks you, do you know JavaScript? They don't necessarily only mean jQuery,
right?
Although jQuery is so popular and used and known by so many people. In most cases, a lot of front-end devs might not go deep into the JavaScript quirks
yeah.
as much because it's sort of hidden away by jQuery, and that's really one of some of the more mm-hmm. powerful features of jQuery, and that it really simplifies your life as a developer. And it just makes everything so much more pleasant.
Yeah. No, I mean,
I was going to say awesome,
yeah.
but then I stopped myself.
Oh, yeah.
I was just like,
you know what that is? That's the sound of your vocab increasing. Nice. Good
yes.
job there. So
awesome.
So we're going to walk through the example with the
yeah,
jQuery
so,
to explain that.
So let me actually show you right on the code base where I actually include jQuery. And it's in the layout.jade file. The reason why I do that is simply because I'm going to use jQuery everywhere. It's probably
it's like a tagline, jQuery everywhere.
Yeah, like it should be their tagline, I think. Now here's something that's interesting. What I'm doing here is instead of referencing a local jQuery file, I'm actually loading it from ASP.NET CDN.com. And the reason why I do that is simply because ASP.NET CDN is a CDN, and a CDN is a content delivery network. So what that means for commonly used files like jQuery that almost the majority of websites have included at some point, using a CDN means that this file will be on a server closer to you, the browser. So it'll make loading of their page a lot faster, and it'll reduce the impact on your server of serving yet another file. So ASP CDN,
you know, and also like for the CDN too, is if someone else has used that exact same CDN and they've visited that site, it might be cached.
Exactly.
So you know, it's
so
already
if
a cached
everybody's
file.
Using
it might
the
be quicker.
Same, yeah, exactly.
Like developers helping developers.
Exactly. That's why I really think that everyone should definitely use a CDN.
Now you can also do a fallback for a CDN for some
of course.
Reason.
Yeah,
you can figure out if it doesn't load, and then
yeah.
you can just dock write or whatever you need
yeah.
to do and include, you know, a local version.
Let's say in the really rare case that a CDN goes down,
yeah.
You can still have a fallback in your existing JavaScript in your HTML so that it will load the one that's on your server as opposed to the one on CDN.
Yep.
Now, the CDN that I'm using is one that we're hosting, and it includes a whole bunch of different libraries that you can use, among them jQuery, among them mm-hmm. jQuery UI, but there's other ones as well, including Bootstrap. So we could have loaded Bootstrap from the CDN directly,
mm-hmm.
And it would have been a lot faster, but we won't be doing that just to show you how
we're just mixing it up,
yeah,
keeping you guys on your toes.
Exactly. But there's other libraries that you might have heard of, like Modernizer,
yeah.
Knockout JS, perhaps even Globalize JS and Respond JS.
Yeah.
So all of these libraries are hosted.
Respond is the one that basically will take non-modern browsers and emulate responsiveness, doesn't it? You know, like basically writes in a whole bunch of stuff, I think. Am I putting you on the spot? Yes.
You are
putting,
putting you on the spot.
I'm pretty
yeah.
sure that's what Respond does.
we can double check. It's yeah, you're right. It's a polyfill
yeah.
for responsive design.
Yeah. Plus one. Plus one, gonna eat cake.
Awesome. Okay. So it's a great CDN to use. There are other ones available out there. I believe some of them are used by other like some of them will host more specific
mm-hmm.
JavaScript files
mm-hmm.
and CSS files as well. So going back to our code base, this is where I've included jQuery. So you can see that I'm loading jQuery 2.1.1.min.js.
Right.
And this is going to load straight from the CDN. The other thing that I need to do to include Socket.io is and Bootstrap is actually include those files. So in the case of Bootstrap, what you want to do is you want to include the JavaScript portion of Bootstrap. Now, Bootstrap is a CSS framework, but there is still a JavaScript component that makes some of the more
more
complex components. Think of tabbing, where you need to hide things using that functionality is included in the Bootstrap JavaScript file. So you definitely need to include that, especially if you're building on top of what we've given you in the GitHub repo. The other thing that we need to include to add Socket.io is include the file as well. Now, here's something that's really cool about the Socket.io project. The Socket.io project actually will serve the JavaScript file for you, right? So if you include it in your your Node app, right, as we've done in this app in particular, it will actually register a URL /socket.io/, and then if you hit up this path on that URL, it will serve the specific Socket.io JavaScript client file for that version of Socket.io, because the protocol will tend to change every once in a while. With this, though, it will serve the correct one for the one that you're running. And just to prove to you, we don't actually have it anywhere here in the JavaScript folder.
Right.
So
I wondered about that. That's pretty awesome. So just by doing the require on the server side,
and then attaching the app, the Socket.io to the app,
right,
you get it.
Right. So automatically, it's almost like it's dynamically writing that path in for you, so you don't have to worry about it, and it just resolves it.
Exactly.
Cool.
It's very cool.
I just learned something new. I didn't know that.
Awesome. So that's how you can include Socket.io, Bootstrap, jQuery, and the next thing I guess I want to show you is the stylus.
Yeah.
So stylus is this middleware that is included in our Node app, and we mentioned that in module 3, I believe, where we required
so many
stylus.
Modules.
Yeah,
so little time.
Exactly. So we included stylus as a middleware. And what is stylus? Stylus is this CSS preprocessor that makes your CSS so much more simpler and easier to write. Now, you mentioned other ones, including Less and Sass. Stylus is another one that is included in the generator for an Express app.
Right.
Now, of course, you don't have to use Stylus. You can use Less or Sass. And there's different ways to include the same middleware into your Node app for those specific preprocessors. But what it will do is the minute that a file is being served that is a that has a .styl file extension, it will compile it down to the actual CSS. So if you don't believe me, here's my style
file. We're just full of non-believing you.
And the minute that I serve this, so you can see, and I'm going to make it so that Visual Studio will also include files that are not in the project.
And again, so, like all of these preprocessors kind of have their own formatting and structure for how you need to write stuff and how it gets compiled down.
It's everybody,
they all have their own features.
Everybody wants to do it their way.
Yeah.
You know, and it's totally fine. Each one of them has their different advantages. Stylus is one of them that's super minimal. It's very much like Jade. It's almost extremely similar to Jade. Like, it just drops a lot of the tags, drops a lot of the things, makes things a lot cleaner.
Yep.
So here's an example of Stylus. And just to prove to you that the Node preprocessor is actually compiling its .css, I'm going to open this folder just to show you. Node.css here. But the minute that I run this Node app, and then I open this folder, and ideally it should be here.
It's that moment.
Moment where you wonder, what
is it putting it there, or is it going to put it in your CSS folder?
Let's double check. Yeah, it should be there. Either way, it is serving it. We can double check that, that's for sure. There it is. So if it is serving it, then there is a CSS file somewhere. Okay, There's our style.css. If I open this, it is actually converting our CSS into
CSS folder?
Mm-hmm. So it should be in the CSS folder. For some reason, it did not show up. Let me open it again. Oh, there it is. It was there the whole time. It was just not
delaying.
Yeah.
Just like, I'm going to wait.
Put Rami on the spot so that he gets confused or something.
So that's like one of those, when it comes to preprocessors, there's kind of usually two veins of thought, I think. One is they're really good for development, and then you compile them. And when you push anything to production, you're never going to compile on the client side or any of that kind of stuff. It's already going to be compiled down. So it becomes more of a development thing.
Yeah.
Whereas here, we see more the requests being made. It's going to go and make sure that we have that file if there's been any updates or changes or whatever. Because I'm assuming it's not going to go and render it every time.
No, it'll save it once. And the minute it gets changed, it'll...
Right, and then it'll just reference that. So, you know, this might, for example, this example of Stylus might work for your workflow or it might not, depending on what you're using, right? You might decide that you're going to have a task runner or something that's going to already, you know, pre-compile stuff, and then you just include it. But the option's there. So, you know, depending on how you work, you know, it could be great.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So there's a couple of really interesting things that's in our stylus. Now, typically chat rooms for a long time have had the message box be at the bottom of a page.
Yep.
So if you look at it, seems to be always at the bottom. If you remember MSN in the old days, it had, well, it's still.
When I had like my name with a number at hotmail.com.
Exactly. When I was using MSN, the chat box was always at the bottom. Even today's link and Skype, that's always typically at the bottom.
Yeah.
And then you've got a button on the right. Now, in HTML, that's actually not easy to do.
No, it's hard, especially with all the different browser types and stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. There's just no easy way to attach something to the bottom of your browser window. But if you notice that we've done this here, and I'm just going to explain a little bit the CSS and the thinking behind this, that basically lets us attach a toolbar to the bottom of a page.
Gotcha.
So
if it's kind of static, right? Like it's just always sitting. Yeah.
It's always sitting there. So if you go back to our layout, in our index.jade, if you remember, there's this interesting class that's clearly not a Bootstrap class. Mm-hmm. It's just, it seems a class that I've added in there, and it's just not wrap. And then there's this other one that's called push. Mm-hmm. Now, we need this to be able to tell the CSS handler in the browser that we want to push the footer, which is its own class, on the same level as the wrap container to the bottom. And the way that we do that is, first of all, we always set the body to be the height of 100%. So it takes up the full browser window.
Right.
And then we set the wrap to be a minimum of 100%, but we give it a margin of the footer size. So in that case, what we're doing here is we're saying, hey, the height is 100%, take up all the available space, but remove 60 pixels.
Right.
And the reason for that is because we want this little push container to have the same size as the footer container so that the browser will push both of these elements to the bottom after the wrap container with a height of 60 pixels. And that's pretty much what forces the text box area and the button to stay at the bottom no matter how much I resize my browser. Pretty neat CSS trick. You know, you'd think that the CSS would make this easy, and I think there is a bit of an easier way to do it in CSS 3, but for the moment, this method is the most cross-browser compatible one that I could think of.
Yeah, and it's more of a modern browser kind of approach, because depending on what browsers are going back in time, something like the height 100% wouldn't necessarily work. So it is definitely one of those more modern browsers approaches, but yeah, you're right. Anytime you're trying to like anchor anything to a certain place and have it static, it's a little bit of a nightmare, and vertically and horizontal line.
Yeah.
Once again, those things are all changing,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And there's way easier approaches now. You know, back in our day, you know, that was
the standards are getting a lot better at it, and it's getting a lot easier, especially with the box sizing and box model and all that stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of new changes that are new-ish changes that are really awesome when it comes to those kind of common things you do again and again, and yet there's really, you know, you still have to go through the nightmares of trying to get it to work.
Yeah. So now that we've covered adding libraries to our Jade file, attaching and understanding what Stylus is doing, I think the next part is really to connect the back end to the front end using the Socket I/O libraries that we've included in our project now that we were serving through Node.
Yeah, so we have to kind of worry about listening for messages.
Exactly, listening and sending messages. Yep. So now if you remember in our index.jade, we had this body end tag. And the reason why we do that is because in our layout.jade, we don't want to have a block that is for the JavaScript tags, because that will typically mean that it will delete all of those JavaScript tags the minute we override that block. Mm-hmm. So instead, what I like to do, and you can do the same thing for the CSS, we mentioned it in the last module, I like to do is I like to add an empty block at the end of different different elements, elements that are important to a certain degree because they'll tend to be reused. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is at the end, I want to be able to override this block to add something after the existing JavaScript files are there. Mm-hmm. And this is exactly what we did in the index.jade file. In this case, we're adding a index.js file, something specific to this page.
Yeah, I mean, we used to, and I still do this a lot in the same kind of syntax that you're using, to do production and development environments where I might path my CSS differently. Mm-hmm. So I might not point to min files. I might point to whatever, you know what I mean, open, like non-minified files. Yeah. So I could just replace them if I needed to replace them. And based on if I'm in dev or production mode, it would just replace that content block.
Exactly. So looking at index.js, it looks fairly short. There's about 12 lines of code, and 13. That's with me adding more spaces, just simply to spread things out a little bit so you understand what's going on. Now, if you remember, we included the Socket I/O library, and if you look at our app.js, you'll notice that the way that we call Socket I/O is by requiring Socket I/O and then passing it the server, and that returns an I/O variable. It's the API is extremely similar in the client side. The difference is, as opposed to getting all of the connections, all the WebSocket connections, I'm asking the WebSocket I/O engine to just create one socket for me.
Right.
And in this function, you can actually pass it different URLs, different things. So if you don't want to connect to the server that served this page, you can actually connect to using WebSockets to other URLs as well.
Right, so you might have like a server that's kind of hosting that somewhere remotely, and you might say, I'm going to connect to that server.
Or maybe if that server is someone else's server and they let you do third-party connections in their Socket I/O server, then you're even able to connect to other servers out there, other URLs.
Right.
So very neat stuff that you can do with it, and it's quite simple. We just create a socket, and the first thing that I want to do is probably hook up my send message button, right? Mm-hmm. How else would I be able to send messages to my server? So I'm going to use jQuery to select the send message button. Now, I gave it a specific ID. So in this case, you actually don't really need jQuery. You can just like use the DOM API to get this element by ID. Yeah. But I like to just use jQuery, especially it just makes things a lot easier.
Because you like it.
And I like
awesome.
It. It's awesome. You're right. It's awesome.
Awesome.
See, I'm not the only one that says awesome, right? So here I am. So if I remember it, like, I'm going to open up my index.jade. I'm just going to put it right next to it. I'm going to make this smaller so that you guys can see. But here I am. Here's my send messages button. It's this button right here. It's the one that's on the second column. So anytime that this button is clicked, I want to execute this function. Again, we're using callback-based programming. Mm-hmm. And in this case, I want to take the value of the message box. And it's this message box right here, the input tag.
Right.
So I'm going to get this the value of this message box, and I'm going to store it in this variable called message. Now, to get this message to the server, the minute that I connect using Socket, all I need to do is call emit with the channel that I'm on, so the chat channel, with the message that
it's
I want to send.
Be the same name that we've been using on the server side, on the client side.
Exactly. It's the same channel that we're all connecting to.
Mm-hmm.
It's the chat channel.
Right.
The
chat channel.
The chat channel.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So with socket emit, I can send that message over.
Yeah.
Now, if you remember what I said earlier, in the app.js file, whenever I get a chat message and I go to broadcast that message to everybody else who's connected to the WebSocket server, it won't send it to the person who actually sent that message.
Right.
So it won't send you duplicates. So what you'll need to do is you'll actually need to append it yourself to the messages container that's going to contain all of the messages.
Right. So if you're emitting the event, you're not getting it back yourself.
Exactly.
So you need to manage that however you're going to manage that yourself.
And in some cases, maybe you don't even want to do anything because the value's already changed or something's going on.
Yep.
Depends what your application is trying to do.
Yeah.
But in this case, we do want to add it to the message box because we want to know what we just sent, right?
Yeah.
And
I want to know why you responded the way you did. What did I say again? Short-term memory.
Yeah. And the other thing that we want to do is we want to empty out the message box so that we can type in a new message as well, right?
Right.
And we do that by setting the value to an empty string. Now, if I actually run all of this stuff, I go to my Node app. I'm going to close it, clear the screen just so you can see it from the beginning. Here I am running it again. Okay, well, I already had a browser that was open. And in this case, I'm going to refresh.
Yeah.
Here I am.
I love that the whole, like, anytime you're running Node or any of these kind of things on the command line, you see, like, the connections that are being made.
Yep.
And it really it helps you kind of, like, make sure that you know that things are being served up the way they should be served up and that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's awesome. So the minute I refresh this page, I get a user connected.
Yep.
And then the server is sending me some chat message, which I haven't quite explained how we're doing that. How we're receiving that and adding it to the message box. That's the next function I'm going to cover.
You've got
now,
time.
I actually want to show you how to, I just want to prove to you that when I send a message out, it'll actually emit it to everybody else. So let's say, hello, Stacy. All right.
Hello.
Now, I'm going to open up another tab. I'm going to put it on the side right here, and I'm going to browse to the same page. All right. And the minute I send hello, Stacy, it pops up on the other end.
That's
hooray! We've got like a chat engine going on, no?
And this is actually how you test it. Like a lot of people are like, oh, how do you know? Like, and it's like, you open up two browsers is what you do.
Yeah.
Like, you open up two browsers.
Yeah, and I can send it from this side, hello, Remy.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that this is Stacy and this is Remy. If I send this message, it pops up over here, and it pops up on my other side.
So you're basically having a conversation
with myself
in two browser windows.
It's typically what happens.
just a little insight into your life right there, right?
Now, maybe a little too much, but anyways. So let me show you what's happening on the console window. The minute that this message is sent using the socket emit function, you can see that it's being inserted into the database, and that's because if we go back to our app.js file, you'll see right at the top, here's my socket on chat engine, Mongo Connect. The minute I get a message, connect to Mongo, insert it into my database, and then write this message saying chat inserted.
Yep.
And then, of course, broadcast it to everybody else.
And, you know, if you were kind of running Mongo and you had, you clicked it and it was running and you saw it up in your command window, you would see these connections also being made to Mongo in terms of something being connected and inserted as well.
That's right. So if I actually move to Mongo, here it is. Connection accepted. It's getting all these connections opened and things are being inserted as we're getting them back.
Yay, it works. That's so exciting.
It works, yeah. We've got a chat room. And it only took it, like, I mean, look at this. 76 lines of code.
It's not, I mean, and you know, when you think about it, it could have been, I'm sure we could go in and make less if we had to.
Yeah, we can definitely cut things out. We can make it
13
shorter.
13 lines,
you know,
whatever.
I mean, like, who needs, like, spacing, right?
Yeah,
like,
no. That, we'll just modify it. We'll modify it and it'll be good.
So think about it. Like, 76 lines of code to get a whole chat room running with Node and database. space saving and retrieving the last 10 messages that we received.
Yeah.
Like, this is some powerful stuff that we've gotten here.
And the thing also, when you think about that, is that, like, we've talked previously about how you can extend this example in adding in authorization or private chat rooms, and that's really not a lot more code. It's just including a couple modules, figuring out how they work, a couple callbacks, and then you're pretty much good to go. So, you know, you might have to change some UI, but you can start to see how this modular system just allows you to plug and play a lot of things, you know, in functionality. You think of new functionality, you look for a module. You know,
yeah, exactly. And in fact, there's a philosophy with Node in the sense that
people... Oh, here we go.
Oh. All right.
Armchair philosophy.
Philosophy. I see. I got the beard for it. I can definitely
pull off
the
philosophy thing. I do that all the time and people just look at me weird. And I'm like, ah, oh, whatever.
Awesome. So...
awesome.
I think, like, we need to have, like, a counter or something. I think that's going to be my thing. From now on, all of my future MVAs, you're going to have to put, like, a little, like, I don't know, like, tennis counter or something. Like, 15 points for saying awesome.
So what's the philosophy?
Right. So
you kind of led us there and
yeah,
then dropped
just
off.
Like, we just started talking about my, like, addiction to this word. Awesome. I think I blame TV. I think I watched too much TV when I was younger. Anyways, let's get back to the philosophy. Let's get back into my beard stroking mode. What's the philosophy behind Node modules? Ideally, it's very similar to an older philosophy that existed with another operating system. And that was, you want to have one thing that does a specific thing well. You don't want to have a module that does too much and doesn't do anything well. You want to just have one module doing one thing really well. And that's why you'll have lots of different modules that are going to be a lot smaller. Some of them are even just a single file. And they will do something very specific, and they'll do it well enough that you, when you merge them all together, everything just seems to work as well as it should be.
Like requests.
Like requests, for example.
You know, all it does is it handle, you know, requests like async. All it does is it handle the async calls and how can you bootstrap them so they all kind of work together and handle that kind of stuff. So that's pretty, I mean, it's pretty common. It's like, oh, you want to use Dropbox API or OneNote or whatever. There's a module and it just handles that.
Exactly. And that's the really cool part behind the module system that we've got, and NPM lets you do that really simply. Like, it's so easy to create a module in Node. Mm-hmm. Any folder that has a package.json, so if we're taking a look, like, say, some of the simpler stuff, this could be a module. If I gave my package.json, this is the name of my module. If I actually push this to NPM, I could do NPM install _03_file.io, and it will find it, and it will install it, and it's that simple.
I think you should do that, because that's how I'm going to look for it. Like, _03, file, whatever.
Yeah, I think I probably, like, would like to choose something a little smarter as a naming convention, but this is for our demos. It just makes things a lot easier. One last thing I wanted to show you with connecting the front end to the back end. We glossed over it, but to be honest, it's just two lines of code. That's how simple it is. It's how do you actually append the messages that you receive from a socket to the browser. Now, do you remember the socket.on function? It's the same one that we're going to use here. So we're going to say, hey, this socket, anytime I get something on the chat channel, take this message, using jQuery, select this messages box, and append a paragraph tag with this text.
Right.
That's how simple it is. And that's what actually enables our browser to add in anything that we receive from the socket. The minute I press a send button, I'm manually adding it on my browser, but the other browser on the other end is doing it through this call right here.
Right. So it's that simple in terms of just saying, this is when this happens to this channel. So if you were listening to multiple channels, you know, you could have another function, whatever it may be.
Yeah, I could add another socket.on function, maybe say admin, and then say, hey, my function is going to take a command, and with this, and you see Visual Studio likes to do nice styling for me. Thank you very much, Visual Studio. I can do something
you're
else.
You're welcome.
I can do something.
That's what Visual Studio sounds like. You're welcome.
I can say alert admin command.
Yeah.
Woohoo. That's how simple it is.
So, you know, the ability, again, to extend that interface and potentially do other things with it if you needed to.
Exactly. Yeah. You can do a private channel. So this could be the ID that we're using. So var current chat room ID equals some number in our MongoDB database. Yep. Lots of numbers.
Once again, world's fastest typer.
Voila. Voila. And this is now a specific chat room channel.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, the flexibility given there is pretty incredible. Like, I just imagine using this for, like multi-user games would be so much fun, you know? Or multiple people connected to control something. Like, you could really extend what Socket.io is trying to do here, but the ability to kind of subscribe to multiple messages or multiple channels, rather, that whole kind of, observer and publisher subscriber kind of pattern is awesome. And it's just so, I hate saying it's so easy to use because it's always like, it's just that easy, but it is, you know, it's fairly like a couple lines of code. And I think it's really cool what you showed too about like how on the server side, if you're including it, it automatically kind of writes that in for you. So you know, because if I didn't know that and I was looking at the code base, I'd be like, where did this come from? You know, what's happening here? I don't see it in the file package. So I think it's great that we went through that because I think some people out there who are probably working through it probably were just like, I don't know where this file is. I think you're missing a file, yet it seems to run okay.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, oh, it's mystery.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that definitely the Socket.io URL here, it's like magic. I like it.
So, you know, we've covered some listening and handling messages. We've shown how to kind of send those messages. You know, again, like we have stuff running locally, so it's going to work. You know, I'd have to come over and go on one browser while you go on the other. Like, don't look at mine. But again, if you had that URL where you could expose it publicly to me, you know, I could be in a browser, you know, working on, you know, having a chat of some sort with you. And all that stuff is going to the local DB. So if you're thinking about deploying it, you know, there's a couple steps that you got to think about in those senses, like, okay, your IT, your DB, like, where is that? You know, because you're going to want to change that potentially. Maybe not. Depends on how you deploy, right? You got to think about, you know, your minified files. You got to think about, you know, a couple of those other things that, you know, what port you're running on and things like that when you go and you kind of put it out there. But when you're working on the stuff locally, you can kind of see how you can set up your environment and just get up and running fairly quick. The next step, obviously, if you're doing something that's multi-user or got that kind of communication, is that you're going to have to, you know, throw it out somewhere where people can actually access it so you can test it properly, because two-browser trick is what we all do. But I mean, you know, that's...
Yeah, we want to put it somewhere...
You want to verify.
That's publicly available so that you can see what... Like, you can test things with other folks as well.
Yeah.
And there's different solutions to do that. So if you wanted to just expose the local host that you have, there are some tools to do that as well.
Sure.
But it's just a little bit more complicated. I like to just deploy things because it really gets me to simulate an actual deployment.
Yep.
I like having a staging environment. So I code on my dev machine, I do my dev testing here, then I stage something to the cloud, test it again, and before I actually move it to production.
Yeah, and I feel like that's a pretty popular workflow in the same way. I'm local to get stuff up and running and to test or to experiment, and then as soon as I know that something's kind of good and I've got like an environment that's set, I try to replicate that environment in a production or in staging server and then, you know, move from there, so to speak. So I think, you know, I think we've covered Socket.io.
Yeah.
We've covered kind of hooking in that back end to that front end. Again, you know, we could easily go and check to make sure those messages in Mongo are being saved. We could go to the DB, you know, and see that they're being saved. But we've integrated all that stuff. So we've got a working application, you know, for all intents and purposes, but now what do we do with it?
Yeah.
That is just sitting on our machines. It's kind of isolated, so.
Yeah, so and that's what the next module we'll be talking about. We'll be showing you how you can deploy to Azure and in different ways so that you can deploy your chat room to the cloud. Now, if you don't share the chat room URL, you might even be able to keep it a private chat room.
Yeah.
You gotta obfuscate it though a little bit. You gotta make sure the URL has like some complex number scheme or something.
Yeah.
You share that URL with your friends, then you've got a private chat room. But for the most part, if someone discovers that one, we haven't added authentication.
Yeah.
We haven't added private rooms. That's up to you guys to do that. But we will show you how to get it up on the cloud.
You know, and there's other things like just that, like once again, that database URI that you need. I mean, we set stuff in a path variable. So like when you deploy it, how do you do that? Like how do you set environment variables and things like that? Because, and also, you know, it's one of those things when you're working with source control, depending on how you're working, if you're working, especially with something like GitHub, you don't want those values in your project, especially if it's an open repository. I don't want to see like what, you know, depending
on
the values.
But you don't want to show those private keys, right? Like,
right.
Like sometimes, the Mongo URI, you can put in the password and the username that you need to connect on.
Yeah.
Now, you don't want to have that in your source control at all, actually.
Yeah.
And that's the reason why we use the environment variable, is because we don't want to share that private sensitive information that have anyone be able to connect to our database.
Right, and so that's like one of those things where you go to source control, GitHub and stuff like that, and you'll see in the README, you need to replace this and you need to replace this. You can find it here, here, here. But we'll walk through a little bit, and the next thing is just like, and this is very common when you're deploying, I think, database, any kind of keys, so like API keys, for example, you don't want that in your source control. You might be deploying from source control, you might not. You know, so if it's public, we're gonna kind of walk through just setting that up on the server. Can I give you a little preview of Azure and just like all the things that are available to you when you're debugging and deploying? Because we know a little bit how to debug a little bit locally. We've seen a couple things that we've done. We'll go through a little bit more detail. But when you put that up into the cloud, how do you start debugging? And so we're going to focus on that kind of stuff in the next module. So we're going to take a 10-minute break. We'll be back and we'll handle debugging,
deploying.
I said debugging. Like we have a pug around here. Yeah, exactly. You hear that?
He's right down there.
We're gonna debug and then deploy and talk you know, a little bit about that and the tools that are available for you to do those kind of things very, very easily from Visual Studio. So 10-minute break. Hope you stick around and we'll see you shortly.